I want to tell a little bit in my sermon about the General Conference of Elders. It was very profitable. The theme was, go into all the world. And we had five on Sunday. Saturday night. Started out Saturday night that they had the room with every international area got a table, and we put displays of things from that country, Italy, Germany, many other areas, several places in Africa. Some of them, like Italy, were very popular because they had snacks and drinks from the area. We didn't have any jollof rice or cassava to bring from Nigeria, but it was really nice. Let me see if I have here. I forget how many of the tables were around there at that time. Maybe in here. I've got a sermon notes from Mark Mickelson. He was there. And I've got his notes, and I thought, well, let's just be lazy and use some of his material. But it was very good. We had that night, everybody went around, saw all the international areas and could talk to people and see the displays that we put out. And there was an information sheet that I mentioned, and Dari had put it together. Dari, we were hoping, could make it from Nigeria for the first time. He's been taking trips. He's been to China on his own business. He's been to India. He has a visa now to go to the UK. So he's been turned down two or three times for the US. But we feel now that with him having gone to these other countries, they will give him a visa to the US. The big problem of giving Nigerians visas, is that they come here, they get a job, and then they never leave. They were supposed to be here, maybe get a 3-month visa, but they come and never go home. And so they need to have some proof that someone will go home. So if somebody's very wealthy in Nigeria, they figure, well, they'll come back. But unless you have a lot, and you have to prove it, they often don't give you a visa. But if he goes to the UK and he returns home, one of Dari's clients is the man who is the head of Merck, the pharmaceutical, for Nigeria. So he runs Merck in selling things in Nigeria. He has Dari working for him as a consultant, and he takes all of his employees to the UK once a year, and he filled in Dari as an employee, which he is a temporary employee, and so he was able to get it. But at least we hope that next time Dari can make it. But he was supposed to do the presentation the next day. Five areas were chosen, international areas were chosen to do a presentation. And we wanted Dari to do the one for Nigeria. They had Nigeria this year, but he didn't make it, so I did the presentation. Although it was a lot of slides that he had put together for it. Then we had some seminars telling people how to go to different countries and return, what it's like. Would you like to serve in Africa? Would you like to serve, go over to some other countries and serve? And we had different seminars. And we had West Africa. Melvin Rhodes and Mark Mickelson and I did the seminar, hour and a half seminar. We gave most of it to Melvin because I had the one the day before. And just explaining how to get there and come home alive, if you want to go. So, I want to mention something, though, that there were some areas that have been upset recently with the administrative changes in United Church of God. Now, some of you are probably very aware of that if you're one of these people who surfs the internet and looks for things like that. One thing I appreciate, I don't really know of anybody in the Nashville or Bowling Green area who is upset, who is not trusting God, who is angry. You take it that God is in charge, that Jesus Christ is the head of the church. The differences have been this. Everyone wants to preach the gospel and feed the flock. Those are the two commissions that we hold very high. And every true member with God's Spirit has in their heart the desire to see the good news preached around the world and the desire to see God call people and that those people be fed. And I know that's in your hearts, it's in my heart, and it's in the hearts of everybody who's been in the administration. It's been in the hearts of everybody who's been on the Council of Elders. Now that's the easy part. The difficult part is, with limited resources, where do you put those resources? And on what? I mean, besides, how much do you put into feeding the flock as opposed to preaching the gospel? When you take preaching the gospel, which is where the biggest differences of opinion come, where do you put that limited amount of money that God has given us? And there have been some who have felt very strongly, who are on the council, that we need to put, at least try and put some into commercial television. And they've been asking for that for over 2 years. And a resolution was made, as far as I know, over 2 years ago by the council, that asking the administration to do that, to at least make some trial efforts in sort of mid-size cities, markets, getting on television where it's not as expensive as, say, New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, but to try some of these areas just to see what kind of response will come. Because they feel that even though you don't reach as many people for the same amount of money on TV, they feel you get a bigger impact. And the responses that you get are more lasting than just doing it over the internet. But others feel that the internet, everybody feels the internet's very important for preaching the gospel. I don't know anybody who doesn't feel that on the administration or council. But should that be the main way? Should almost all the money to the exclusion of other ways to preach the gospel? And should the good news and subscriptions to it be minimized? And let try to encourage people to read the good news and the booklets and all on the internet. It does save some money if people would do that. Now, most of us who are older, we've got no interest in that. You get on the internet, you read a page, you go somewhere else. Whereas if you have a good news, you put it in the bathroom and eventually it gets all read. You know, you read the whole thing. So it just depends maybe on somebody's age or maybe not. I don't know. But there has been some disagreement. And remember, I'm not going to turn to it right now, but Paul and Barnabas had serious disagreement where it was sharp, it says, in the end of Acts 15, over whether they should take Mark with them. And so it's not unusual with human beings to not agree on everything. I mean, my wife and I don't agree on everything. And many times if you don't agree with somebody, it can end up being sharp. So there had some areas, some few areas. I did hear of one international area that had serious disagreement with the council. And I would say to the point of anger. to the point of anger. And I disagreed with that. I should have brought it, but I put on Elders Forum that if I disagree with the council, there are ethical ways I can express my disagreement. But one way is not to cause division among God's people. And I ended it by saying, my job is to lead His sheep by the still waters, not to muddy up the waters. I got a lot of people telling me, thank you for that or several that I've put on Elders Forum. Matter of fact, Mr. Hanaway here said his brother, who is an elder, wanted to express his thanks for that. But I think most of the elders are that way. I'd say maybe 90%. But you know, if you have even less than 10% who are just a little upset, I didn't meet anybody, to be honest. Maybe they knew my opinion already from Elders Forum. I met not one person at the council who was angry or upset. No, there may have been some, but they didn't express it to me. Everyone there was faithful and trusting in God to guide us. And at the end, and I'm going to get into some verses here in a moment, when it was all over, and some of you who may know these people and know what has happened, Roy Holiday, who's been the chairman of the Council of Elders, and Jim Franks, who has been for the years my boss, charge of ministerial services, that when the whole thing was over and Roy Holiday is acting as still the chairman, they had a closing prayer. He was at front and he called one of the men to have a prayer for our dismissal and safe trip home. And when it was finished, Jim Franks walked over to Roy Holiday, put his arm around him, and then they started talking and laughing and smiling, and I whipped out my phone. I thought, I got to get a picture of this. People will not believe this. And I took the most wonderful picture of them. Roy Holiday had his head back laughing, and they were just having a good time. And somebody walked up to me and started talking to me, and without thinking, I closed my phone. Well, on this phone, if you don't press save, it is gone. Ah! Ah. Well, Mark Mickelson said he's telling his congregation today the same thing that Mark Twain said when the papers said that Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, had died. He said, rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. And Mark said, I'm saying that rumors of our death have been greatly exaggerated. And I want to read Luke 21, verse 19. Luke 21, verse 19. And remember, these are verses that Mark Mickelson put together. He called and said, what are you speaking on? And I said, I don't know yet. I haven't had time. I was so busy yesterday with things happening. Then it got late, and rather than work on the sermon, I said, I'm going to go out before sunset and get some exercise. And came back, showered, went and anointed somebody, came back and ate. Anyway, Luke 21, let me get there, and verse 19. In patience, possess your souls. In patience, possess your souls. And this is the title that Mark gave to this sermon, is based on this verse. And it is, the title he has is, in your patience, possess your souls. That's the title he gave it. In your patience, possess your souls. And then he had two other verses that really talk about patience. One is Matthew 10:22. And I'll turn there quickly. Matthew 10 and verse 22. We know this verse. We usually talk about this verse when we talk about being saved. And what does it mean? When are we really, really, truly saved? It's in the resurrection. And we use the verse for that. Well, he was using it concerning patience. It says, verse 22, "And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved." Now, that's going to take some patience for many of us. Many of us have been patiently waiting for the end for a long, long time, not thinking it would take this long. Well, in the New Testament, they didn't think it would take long. They thought it was going to come in their lifetime. And were they ever wrong? Well, I've been wrong. You've been wrong. We've all been wrong. Peter was wrong. John was wrong. Paul was wrong. They thought it was going to come very quickly. And the other one he has on patience is Hebrews 6 and verses 9 through 15. Hebrews 6, verses 9 through 15. "But beloved, we are confident," this is verse 9, Hebrews 6, 9. "But beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you. Yes, things that accompany salvation, though we speak in this matter." In the book of Hebrews, he's warning them about falling away. He warns them several times about falling away. But he says, "I'm confident of better things, that you won't fall away. Yes, things that accompany salvation, though we speak in this manner." Even though we're talking about warning you that you can lose out on your salvation. "For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you have shown toward His name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister." God remembers our service. "And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end, that you do not become sluggish, but imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promise." Notice, imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promise. Just as the previous verse said, to the full assurance of hope until the end. When the end is going to come. That there's a waiting. There's a patience. There's faith involved. There's trust in God. Verse 13. "For when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, 'Surely blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you.' And so, after he had patiently endured," and he had to wait and wait and wait. What was he waiting for? Well, he waited for a son. And he waited a long time for a son. And then he was told to sacrifice him. "After he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise." And we're in the same thing we are patiently enduring. Now, Mark asked this question. If patience is the antidote, that is, like if you take a poison, then you take the antidote. If patience is the antidote, then what is the poison? What poison does patience cure? How do we normally respond if We're not patient. Well, in his mind, we get angry. Anger is often caused by a lack of patience. When we run out of joy, what might happen? We get depressed. When we run out of mercy, what happens? We get judgmental. But when we run out of patience, we get angry. Patience is what keeps anger out of our hearts. In James 1, verses 19 and 20. James 1. Don't have to turn far from the book of Hebrews. James 1, verse 19 and 20. Therefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Well, we've all seen people who have a short fuse. People learned that a short fuse generally gets them what they want. They think. That is, the child who finds that if he throws a tantrum, his parents give in. Now, hopefully, your parents did not give in to tantrums, and you didn't give in to your children's tantrums. But you have seen a lot of parents who do give in to their children's tantrums and try to appease them. And then when that person gets older, they find that throwing a tantrum gets them what they want. The husband or the wife, rather than see the husband throw another tantrum or the wife throw a tantrum or get angry, they're very careful to let him or her have what they want. It's easier to just give in than to try to deal with that tantrum. And it works for them. That's no good. And after a while, folks tiptoe around, but they find it works. But that's not God's way. Slow to speak, slow to wrath. In the Old Testament, it speaks of God's wrath, but it says He was very slow and He bore long with them. He bore with Israel very long before He sent the Assyrians to haul them off in, 721, the end of 721 B.C., beginning of 722, I think they actually ended up being hauled off past Assyria. And then He dealt long with Judah before He finally hauled them off in three stages to Babylon. But you and I have seen a lot of people who are quick to wrath. But it's not godly. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. It might get results, but they're not good results in the long run. When we were talking, and I sent something. How many of you are familiar with the news organization called Stratfor? Two, three? Okay, it stands for Strategic Forecast. And it costs money, about $200 a year. They offered me 1 year for $99 and I took it. It's got a lot of good information, tells about what's going on in Nigeria, around the world. And it gives information you really could almost say you don't get anywhere else. What's behind the scenes, what's really going on. And one recent one that they had told about Iraq. In Iraq, the surge has made a lot of progress. We know that. But there are groups in there that are not even Iraqis who are jihadists. And they don't want things to calm down. They want to continue bombing and killing. And it's gotten to be less and less. And one of the, of course, there are several reasons. The Sunnis finally got tired of these people there. But another reason is that they've been able to move faster. That is, they move in on some jihadists that they capture, and then they quickly get information from them, and then they move in on others, and it's real rapid. But how has it happened? It's happened, and let me read this from Stratford. This type of rapid, sequential activity against jihadists by the U.S. and Iraqi forces is not a coincidence. It is the result of some significant operational changes that were made in 2007 in the wake of the American surge in Iraq. The then commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, General Stanley McChrystal, was instrumental in flattening hierarchies. Let me say that again. He was instrumental in flattening hierarchies and reducing bureaucratic inefficiencies in both intelligence and special operations forces activities inside Iraq in order to create a highly integrated and streamlined organization. The result was the capability to rapidly plan and execute special operations forces raids based on actionable intelligence with a limited shelf life. That is, if you have to move fast, they could move fast. You know why they could move fast? They didn't have to always check up the line. He had flattened the hierarchy so that when these people got actionable information, they could move then without having to go all the way up and check and check and check and check. He had flattened the hierarchy. And then to rapidly interrogate any captives, quickly analyze any material of intelligence value seized, and rapidly retask forces in a series of follow-on operations. The resulting high tempo of operations was considered enormously successful and a key factor in the success of the surge, and recent developments in Iraq appear to be a continuation of this type of rapid and aggressive activity. Now, what's the point? The point is, United Church of God chose deliberately to have a flattened hierarchy. By that I mean, we have positions of authority. We have a council. We have a president. We have a operations manager of managers of church administration, media, finance. But we don't have people who just have ranks. I mean, we have pastors, we have elders. But all elders are elders. We no longer have people who are evangelist rank, who don't evangelize. But they were evangelist rank. We no longer have people who are pastor rank. Even some who didn't pastor churches were made pastor rank. We had preaching elder rank. That was below pastor, but above the regular elders, the local church elders. And those were ranks. We don't have that. And we give more opportunity to those to where they don't have to just check everything and can actually make some decisions. Now, you know, the Japanese did that. I bought some vice lock grips the other day that were on sale. I've never owned any actual vice, the brand, vice locked grips. I had some Japanese ones that I think I bought before David was born. He's 45. And inside there's a little tiny spot that said Japan. Now, for those of you who are younger, I want you to know that when I was young, Japanese meant junk. It was cheap, junk copies. And this was a type of vice grip, but it wasn't vice grip. It was a cheap, junk copy, and I've used it all these years. Do you know when the Japanese began turning out high-quality material? It was actually an American. I don't remember his name. Anybody here remember the name of the American who taught them to do quality?
Deming.
He went over and taught them zero defect. But you know how they had to do zero defect? They had to give the lowest person on the manufacturing line the ability to shut down the line if something wasn't right. They had to give the lowest individual on the line the ability to stop the whole manufacturing line if he found a flaw. And they gave the people on the line the ability to find the flaws and bring them to the engineers. And that is when they began having high quality material. And that is where you trust people. You trust deacons. You trust members. You give them opportunity to use innovation. When I came to Nashville, the deacons had to ask me everything. When I say they had to ask me everything, we had one man who wasn't a deacon who actually asked Bill Vernich and myself. He sold his house. He said, "Where should I move?" And Bill Vernich said, "Brentwood." And he said, "I can't afford to move to Brentwood." And Bill Vernich said, "Well, if you're not going to follow advice, don't ask." Now, Bill was being sarcastic. But I remember when we went over to Hunter's Lane School and one time, and they had had a measles outbreak. I've told some of you this story. I had a deacon, not with us, call and ask me, well, he had been told by Paul Kurtz that we should get some disinfectant and disinfect the handles at the school. And he called and asked me how many bottles of disinfectant he should buy. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know." Now, this guy was a deacon, so I facetiously said, "You know, maybe you should ask a deacon that question." Now, he was a deacon, but it was a long, slow process of getting people to realize that I believed in a flattened hierarchy. And United Church of God has chosen to have a flattened hierarchy. Now, let me tell you, there's some good things about a flattened hierarchy, and there's some problems with a flattened hierarchy. By the way, if any of you have seen the article, they had it in Vertical Thought, when 500,000 bullets aren't enough. Any of you ever read that particular article? It was about in Africa when the British were fighting the Zulus down in southern Africa. And they had a chain of command to where you had to have somebody say, "We're this low on bullets," and they had to go to the quartermaster, and there was a lot of rigmarole before they could get the bullets down to the men. But it was all orderly. But because it was so slow, the Zulus with spears defeated their army and killed, even though they had 500,000 bullets sitting in boxes. But because they had an exalted hierarchy. And I understand military can be exalted. Vertical hierarchy. Listen, I probably spent as much time in the military as anybody here, as far as on military bases. Up till I went to college. I grew up learning, you know, driving. When I learned to drive and would drive across base, men would salute me because they'd see the little red sticker that was on the bumper. That meant that was an officer's car, and they had to salute that sticker, and then they'd see this little kid driving and they would be upset. And I learned to answer the phone. Colonel Keller's quarters, Fred speaking. So I understood hierarchy. But you know, when the bullets start flying and the fog of war descends, the general officers have to give the field grade officers authority to make decisions without checking with the general officers. And the field grade officers have to give the company officers, that'd be captain and down, authority to make decisions without checking everything. And the company officers, captains and lieutenants, have to give the sergeants and the platoon sergeants authority to make some decisions. They just can't. When the bullets start flying, the hierarchy starts flattening. And when the bullets stop flying, it starts going up again. We've chosen to have a flattened hierarchy. But there are no ministerial rankings. But there are some problems that can come. What is the weakness of that? You know what the weakness is of a flattened hierarchy that we have? We have to come to an agreement, a consensus, in order to get something done. Now, when you have one man who can make a decision, right or wrong, then he can make the decision like that. But when you're saying, let's work together, like a marriage, you know, in a marriage, the husband could decide to make all the decisions himself. But if he is wise, he will have a flattened hierarchy. I got my whole family together when we moved to Arkansas. And I said, all right, how many of you would like to go out west and go to, seems like it was the Grand Canyon that time. And I had all the facts and figures of our budget. And I said, here's the thing. Within what, by next summer, we can go. I think it was the Grand Canyon the first time, but we also went to Yellowstone. But so I don't know which it was, but I think it was Grand Canyon. I said, here's how much money it will take. And here's the only way we can get it. We have to cut back in this area and cut back in this area and cut back on clothes. Because everybody got a clothing allowance. And they all agreed, let's cut back. Now see, rather than me coming in and saying, I'm cutting your clothing allowance, I got agreement and everybody agreed to cut the clothing allowance. Have I got this story right, friend? Wasn't it Grand Canyon? That's what I thought. David, it was Grand Canyon, you remember? Anyway, that was a flattened hierarchy. I brought them into the decision-making process. We had to all come to an agreement. Now, that can be slow. But it also has everybody working and pulling. They have the kids and Lucretia all had ownership. And that's what we are trying to do. Because, look, when you look in the book of Acts, we see a flattened hierarchy. In Acts 1, they all got together to choose a replacement for Judas. It wasn't just a few guys in a back room. It was all the brethren got together and did it. When you get to Acts 6 and they had to choose some deacons because things weren't working out right, taking care of the widows, they had a flattened hierarchy. They let the members who were Greek-speaking is what it was, go out and choose men and bring it, and then they had ownership of those men. But then the apostles said, whom we will appoint. You find in Acts 15 where they discussed circumcision. It was a flattened hierarchy because they didn't have just a few men. They went to the apostles and elders. They didn't cut the elders out of it. It was a flat. Yes, there were men. Everybody respected the fact that the apostles were the apostles. But they got the input of all of the elders who wanted to be there, who could be there. That's a flattened hierarchy. We have to be able to agree. in order to get things done. And what's the problem with that? Well, if we don't agree, we have to take the time to figure out to where we can agree. Let's notice. See what time I've got here. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 17 through 19. We look at the New Testament and see a flattened hierarchy. You'd say, well, in the Old Testament, Moses, it was not a flattened hierarchy. Yes, but Moses was not the king. Moses had to go out to the, every day he went to the tent of meeting, and God told him what to do. You know, if we had somebody, and I would like to have this happen to somebody in this room, that God comes to talk to you, brings you to talk to you every day. Now, I'm afraid that if you hear a voice, it might not be God. That's my fear. But if we could really prove it was God talking to you every day, we would be glad to have you tell us exactly what we should be doing. We would be asking you questions and saying, now look, when you go to the tent of meeting, and we want to see the cloud come down over the tent. That will help prove that God's really coming. You know, the cloud comes down every time you go in. And we would be happy. But you know, Moses was just the messenger. He was a messenger. He was a prophet. We just don't have anybody like that. I would be happy to have somebody like that, but we don't. You know what we have instead today? God's Spirit. God's Spirit. And God gives a spirit of wisdom and unity to those who will use it and not fight against it. And not fight against it. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 17. Now, in giving these instructions, I do not praise you, since you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when you come together as a church, I hear there are divisions among you, and in part I believe it. For there must also be factions among you. And you know the word division in verse 18 and the word faction in verse 19, same Greek word. Factions, divisions. There must be divisions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you. We like to say, why is there division in God's church? And this verse says there should. We know other verses say there shouldn't be. But this verse says there must be divisions. That those who are genuine can be recognized among you. And so God can see who's genuine. He sees who is seeking to be unified and who is seeking to be divided. He wants to see which pastors are stirring up their congregations and which ones are leading them beside still waters. Which members have the faith of patience and the patience of faith. And which ones get all upset and don't put the faith in Jesus that they should. Let's see if I... Here it is. Here's what I was going to get. Here's a nice letter. Well, the first one may not be. This is a friend of ours. And there was trouble in her church area. And somebody had there were two children who were lost or died. I say children, young adults. In the same family. And this one person is a member who has come to us out of another church group where there was one guy in charge, one true church. And she and her husband are now in United. And this other friend, who's still in another church group with one person in charge, sent condolences and said this to Lucretius and my friends. There is such deceit going on in all the churches of God. I hope Christ will return soon to put it all straight. I keep wondering if the doctrine of the Nicolaitans in Revelation 2 is that horribly strict government of, then she names a church, which I will not name, and others. Such abuse! Where's the hallmark of the church mentioned in 1 John, love of the brethren? It's so sad to see such things in truth-keeping organizations. So sad! But I do think we are so close to the end, I hope and pray anyway. I'm glad you aren't being subjected to it anymore, because our friend came out of a group like that, one of the worst ones in that way. The Lord rebuked those ministers. What else can we say? Every area differs, but if you don't find the sermons meaty enough, you should try. And then she mentions her church group, which is not united. That's fine. Lucretia said she should write her and say, what do you consider a meaty sermon? You know, because one person might say, this is a meaty sermon. Somebody else said, well, no, that's not a meaty sermon. This is. If you don't find the sermons meaty enough, you should try her church, she names. I find that UCG, that's us, I will name us, varies so tremendously by area. I think they all do. We have to hold fast to the end. I don't have a problem with basically what she's saying here at all. Thanks for the details. I'll be praying for the family. That's really hard to take. Two kids gone that quickly. What a sad story. And here our friend made this reply to her. The church areas in the first century varied greatly. The apostles traveled and taught unification and love. They taught, not condemned, and left it up to each area to work on their strengths and weaknesses. I'm going to interject in this and say that's true. The Philippian church was very different from the Corinthian church. Very different. Isn't it the same today? We have the major commonalities and many disputable differences. What do we focus on? Do we focus on our commonalities or differences? That's her point. I've been to, then names this other lady's church, several times, especially when I visited my sister back home. Most of my hometown girlfriends are in, mentions this lady's church. Last time I went through in February, they played head of the church, or the physical head, DVD on the names of the sermon. After coming out of the one true church, that's the church she had been in, they were the only ones. Everybody else was Laodicean and not going to make it. After coming out of the one true church, so-and-so, being courted by the one true church, a different group, and invited by other one true churches, she names three churches, church groups, I'm not interested in another one true church. I'm already in the one true church. At baptism, I was told it is Christ's body, not an organization. Isn't that true? It's Christ's body. Anybody who has God's Holy Spirit, I don't care what church organization they're in, if they have God's Holy Spirit and they're praying and studying and growing in love and faith, humility, They're in the true church. Doesn't matter what organization. I like this. I'm already in the one true church. At baptism, I was told it is Christ's body, not an organization. It's so simple. We are happy to fellowship with UCG and visit other groups if we are welcome. Now, I like that because what I'm saying is that they've chosen a certain government, certain ones. Now, they're not everybody is, you know, the one true church, but some are. But we have chosen an organization that is a flattened hierarchy. And when you have anything like that, I mean, if you ask the kids, what if I had gotten all the kids together and said, do you want to go to Grand Canyon? And here's where we're going to have to cut the budget. And if three of them had said yes, and one of them had said, absolutely not, I don't want my clothing budget cut at all. Well, then you'd have to work on it, wouldn't you? And see, that's what we're facing. We want everybody to be unified, but we don't want to force things. We want to have a time where we work together and develop, if slowly, a consensus. And so when you do that, there can be some disagreements, just like in a marriage. And that was the point. No, I'm not going to tell you who that lady was. Probably some of you have guesses. But why would you know? Why would you know? In Philippians 2, verses 1 through 4. I want you to know how very, very, very pleased I am to be a part of this organization. Not because our organization is the one true church, but there are people in this organization who are a part of the one true church. There are people who are in the many, we call them splinters, who have God's Holy Spirit, who pray, who keep the Sabbath, who keep the holy days, who tithe, who are seeking humility, who are seeking faith, who are trusting in God, who are growing in the Spirit, and they are all part of the one true church because they have the Holy Spirit. And our government may be a little different. We feel it's closer to what we see in the book of Acts. But there are others who disagree with that. And you know what? I respect them. They should go where their conscience before God and their belief in the Scriptures, where they should be. If that's what they believe God teaches out of the Bible, then that's fine. They're our brothers and sisters. Let's honor them. Let's honor them. But realize some things that we have are going to be, you know, you have a difficulty if you have a vertical government. You have a difficulty if you have a flattened government. Yeah, there are difficulties both ways. And you just have to accept and say, which one is the one that we believe God wants us to have? One person who makes all the final decisions. I do want one person to make all the final decisions. You know who that is? Jesus Christ. But He may do it through some time and some difficulty, but it's always worked out. Philippians 2, verse 1 through 4. Therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love. Now notice the like-mindedness here is having the same love. Being of one accord in what? Agreeing in everything? Of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. Now that takes care of a lot of problems. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. And then, let me look through here. Ephesians 4, verses 1 through 3. Now, he didn't have this one in here. I added this one. And he may have added it to his, because I sent this back to Mark. Mark and I are so very different in personalities, but we love each other and respect each other. I've often said between us, the two of us, Nigerian leadership, between Mark and myself, in the Nigerian leadership, there is perfect balance. By that I mean, Mark is over here toward thinking quick, making solid decisions quickly. And I'm over here somewhere near wishy-washy. But between the two of us and not near either one of us is perfect balance. So it's in between us. That's why I say in between us is perfect balance. But neither one of us are anywhere close to it. Ephesians 4. But we respect each other. We love each other. And we learn from each other. Ephesians 4 verse 1, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to have a walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness. Now, lowly and gentle doesn't mean that you just absolutely won't listen to your brother, that he's wrong, you're right. Lowliness and gentleness with long suffering or patience, bearing with one another in love. Endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. What is the unity of the Spirit? Is it always agreeing? No. If we all agreed on everything, where would the growth come from? You know, as long as they're human beings, we will not agree on everything. Our experiences have made us all very different. So we're not going to agree on everything. So he doesn't say the agreement of never, ever seeing anything different. Where would the learning be? But it says the unity of the Spirit. Now, what is the Spirit? Love? Joy? Peace? Patience? You know, if we all always agreed with each other, would there be any need for patience with each other? If every member of the Council of Elders always agreed, and the administration agreed, and there were never any disagreements, if husbands and wives always agreed, would there be any need for patience? In Poor Richard's Almanac, Benjamin Franklin had, I'm going to paraphrase this, I may not have it exact, it said, keep your eyes wide open before marriage and half shut after marriage. But there can be unity of love and patience and kindness and gentleness and self-control. Those things bring unity. Not agreement in everything, but unity. So he's saying not the unity of total agreement, But the unity of the Spirit, that's the ultimate unity. The unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace.